Guardian Unlimited.
For many people, Christmas doesn't properly get underway until they've heard this sound. Every year bar one since 1928, a service of nine lessons and carols has been broadcast on Christmas Eve afternoon from King's College, Cambridge. And it always begins with a lone treble breaking the silence in the first verse of Once in Royal David City. Countless millions in the United Kingdom and around the world tune in. It is a live broadcast, and in order to take some of the pressure off the individual, a squad of boys is prepared for the solo, as Stephen Clebury, fellow organist and director of music at King's College, explains.
We actually don't identify to the boy himself who's going to sing it until the BBC's red light starts flashing. And that's a system I inherited from my predecessors, and it served me very well because I think it prevents one individual getting really stewed up for 10 days or a fortnight beforehand. But I always make sure that we've got something between four and half a dozen who are, in a sense, papabile, that I know and am confident could do it. So I think I'm pretty confident that we're always going to have a soloist.
Stephen Clebury has been director of music at King's since 1982. This year we'll see his 26th nine-lesson service. Does he still actually like carols?
I do. Of course, there are many different kinds of carols, and on the whole, I tend to perform, obviously, those that I like. And that means anything from medieval carols right through to newly commissioned ones, with a lot of the well-known ones taken in along the way.
Although the King's Service is the model for carol services across the world, the college did not invent the form. That honour, apparently, goes to Truro in Cornwall, where the first formal service of lessons and carols was held in 1880. The King's tradition began in 1918, 10 years before the first annual broadcast, so next year will be the 90th anniversary. What is its importance?
Well, for the church, Christmas, along with Easter, is one of the two major liturgical festivals. And for me, I think the value is that we are representing this story each year in a way which combines old and new. And from a point of view of, almost you might say, from an anthropological point of view, this is quite important because things that are important to people are often expressed through some kind of ritual, be it the changing of the guard or the cup final or the opening of Parliament, whatever it is. So it is, in a sense, a kind of ritual, but in my view, not less valuable because it is.
The huge audience for the King's Carol Service surely make it one of Oxbridge's most celebrated products. Does Clebury perhaps see it as a counterblast against that other Oxbridge phenomenon, the attacks on religion by Richard Dawkins?
I hadn't quite thought of it that way because, of course, I think the Dawkins outblast, as you call it, came later than the first carol service in 1918. But I think the nature of our service is such that it's appreciated by people from a very wide spectrum of religious standpoint.
This recording of Once in Royal is in fact more than 40 years old. It was performed under Clebury's predecessor but one, Sir David Wilcox, in 1965. The service has always begun with it, and always ends with Hark the Herald Angels Sing. These apart, the musical director starts each year with a pretty clean sheet. He gets down to work seriously putting together the musical part of the service in the early autumn, but that's only the half of it.
In a sense, I'm on the lookout all year round for new things and new ideas, and one of the things I've done here with the carol services to commission a new carol annually since 1983 from one of our leading composers, or in some cases a composer from abroad. And that's come about very much through chance and informal contact with composers I might have met in this or that context. I remember standing in the wings at the Albert Hall talking to Harry Birtwistle before a prom we were both involved in, and I said, had you ever thought of writing something for King's College Choir? And he said, no one make me an offer. So those kind of chance meetings that have led to some very interesting pieces. So obviously with a commission like that, I have to have that in place ideally a year before.
And here is Sir Harrison Birtwistle's carol called The Gleam, composed for the 2003 service. tot up the list of carols that Stephen Clebury has commissioned, and you've got a pretty good who's who of contemporary composers, including Thomas Adege, John Woolrich, Peter Maxwell Davies, Alexander Gurr, Judith Weir, Richard Rodney Bennett, and many others. This year, he's ordered a carol from the Australian composer Brett Dean. But performing a brand new carol every year has had inevitable consequences. I imagine you get a fair number of unsolicited carols from amateur composers out there. Is that the case?
It is the case. I do receive quite a lot of unsolicited material, and I would like to be able to tell you that I read every note of all of them. And indeed I used to, but the longer I've been here, the more I receive, and I've just found it's physically not possible to do that. But I do look at them all to some degree or another, and obviously you get more experienced at assessing their worth, and I do reply to every person that sends me a carol.
Has anybody ever had one included who's done it that way?
I knew you would ask. That would be the next question. I think I'd have to stop and think there. Yes, I think the most notable and indeed the most successful one has been an arrangement of Noël Nouvelet by Stephen Jackson, which has now been published and anthologized. But I think I would be right to say that when he first sent it to me, it was still in a manuscript form. And I'm very glad to have played some part in popularizing it, because it's really excellent arrangement.
The choir has been a feature of King's College since its foundation by Henry VI in the mid-15th century. In modern times, it has become a standard setter for the Anglican choral tradition, with highly disciplined and polished performances. On numerous recordings in the 60s and 70s, successive generations of boys established a distinctive tone, beloved by many but too narrow for some tastes. This contrasts with another style of singing associated with the choir, which Stephen Clebury conducted for 3 years before moving to King's. Here, at Westminster Cathedral in London, in the 1950s, George Malcolm had been credited with getting the boys to make a shinier, more full-blooded sound, which some find too raucous. In his quarter century with the King's Choir, has the current boss set out to change the sound?
I think probably not over consciously. If I had my time again, I think I would have wanted to be more conscious about it. But I remember also, of course, my time at St John's, Cambridge, with George Guest. Now, George was a great friend of George Malcolm, and it was George Malcolm who introduced into Westminster Cathedral the so-called continental style of singing, and that has become hugely influential in the UK, in the Anglican choral foundations as a whole. And it started with George Malcolm, and I said to him, you know, how did you get this sound? And he said, well, really, singing is a sort of controlled form of shouting. And said, I was with a friend in Brixton at a church one week, and he'd got these boys to come in off the street, and they'd stopped playing football and got them to come in and sing. And he said, I heard them make this sound, and he said, I thought that's the sound that my boys at Westminster Cathedral ought to make. So when people talk very seriously about continental tone, I always remember that story, because in fact he learnt it in Brixton.
This recording of the carol In Dulce Ubilo was made in 1959, and the boys certainly sound different today, for what of the lower voices, the altos, tenors and basses? In a cathedral choir, these parts are usually sung by adult professional singers, but in the King's College Choir, they are sung by choral scholars, students who are not that much older than the choir boys. What difference does this make?
Our altos, tenors and basses are aged between 19, 21, 22, something like that. That carries, in comparison, say, with a cathedral choir with lay clerks, advantages and disadvantages. The advantages are that the voices are young and more easily blendable, and you also get that youthful enthusiasm that even the best professional can't necessarily reproduce on a daily basis. And the disadvantages are, of course, that when it comes to the big solo, you don't necessarily have the maturity of voice that somebody 10, 15 years older can produce, and they don't have the experience. But for me, part of the stimulus of my work here is the responsibility for teaching them, training them and giving them that experience, which in many cases leads them on to careers in the music profession.
The young undergraduates, how much does this add to their university lives and their daily grind of study?
Well, of course, it does make them very busy, because the choral scholars here are in chapel for a couple of hours a day, 6 days a week. However, I would say that for an able person, and we're lucky to get able people here in our choirs here in Cambridge, that the discipline of having to go to the chapel for 2 hours at the end of the afternoon each day, in fact rubs off onto their academic work as well, because it means there is always a fixed point in the day when they have to be fully operational.
Presumably your choral scholars don't quite get to enjoy their Saturday nights as some of their fellow students might.
Oh, I think they know how to enjoy themselves. We've just been in Brazil for a week. I think I could be pretty sure of that. But they do, of course, have to have a sufficient degree of responsibility to know that they have to present themselves here on Sunday morning.
The stunning opening of Fairfax Carol by Thomas Adders, composed in 1997. He coincidentally had read music at King's College. Given the constant workload on the choir, how much of a bind is it to have to prepare for this annual broadcast to the world?
I remember my predecessor, David Wilcox, when he was asked exactly the same question as you've asked me, said, well, there are two answers. In a sense, the choir is rehearsing all the time because the nature of the choir is that it sings daily the liturgy in the chapel. And in that sense, you're creating, training, nurturing the choir all the time. And what you're going to hear on the 24th of December is arguably, in the way that a CD recording is, a photo of the choir in the state that it is at that particular time. But then, of course, there are the specific pieces to be learnt.
In fact, preparing the actual performance is not so taxing as putting together the programme.
Many Christmas carols are, of course, from the point of view of learning notes, a great deal easier and more straightforward than a lot of the other repertoire we sing, although some of the commissioned carols have been quite taxing in that respect, so I'm always glad to have that copy of the new music well in advance, and then I can try to assess its difficulty and start learning it at an appropriate time. Then again, of course, we have some concerts. For example, we've just been in Brazil for a week giving concerts, in some of which we've included some Christmas carols. So that gives some performance experience of these pieces, but yet you've somehow got to make sure that the wine comes to its full maturity, if I could use that analogy, at 3 o'clock on Christmas Eve in the afternoon. Just comes up to the boil at the right time.
And there's more discussion of today's news every day from 12 noon on Newsdesk. That's Guardian Unlimited's daily news podcast at guardian.co.uk/podcasts.
Guardian Unlimited.